At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
BP says it's going to be a couple of days before we know if the top kill actually did kill the spill in the Gulf of Mexico. They're using pressure to try to hold the oil in the well, which is interesting because the pressure is mounting on BP and President Obama, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com. And by Novo Nordisk, committed to changing diabetes through treatments, partnerships, and education. Defeating diabetes is our passion and our business.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 26th of May, and it is great, as always, to have you here. Funny things can happen 5,000 feet underwater, so nobody really knows yet whether forcing heavy drilling mud into the well is actually going to plug it up. But everybody from the CEO of BP to President Obama has their fingers crossed because patience is running out, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Politicians, environmentalists, and the public are mad at BP, and the government is under pressure to get tough, but it has one arm tied behind its back.
How do you punish the company while they're driving the fire truck, in essence? You know, they're right in the middle of trying to deal with the catastrophe.
That's Michael Lynch, president of the consultancy Strategic Energy and Economic Research.
Essentially, nobody can really run the attempts to stop the well spill except BP at this point. It would be disastrous to pull them out.
Obviously, the government will impose fines, but how much? Lynch says the feds have a tricky task.
Especially the wildlife death is very hard to quantify, so coming up with a number that you can attach to it by saying we're going to charge you X dollars for every barrel would be one way of just trying to round out all the uncertainty, but I'm sure it's going to be years of lawsuits involved.
The government also needs to consider the signals that BP's punishment will send to other energy companies. Severin Borenstein is co-director of the Energy Institute at UC Berkeley.
They need those firms to be taking into account the risk they impose on the rest of society, but they don't want to overstate them so much that the firms are discouraged from engaging in any economic activity at all.
Tomorrow, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar will share the results of a 30-day review of offshore drilling safety. President Obama is expected to use the event to call for tougher oversight of oil rigs and drilling permits. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The social networking site Facebook is working on a balancing act of its own. Users' privacy versus the need to, you know, make money. Not for the first time, Facebook has been in the crosshairs the past couple of weeks over what it's doing with users' information. This is the biggest such backlash in the company's short history. So in San Francisco today, Facebook rolled out some new privacy rules. But as Jeff Horowitz reports, once something's out there online, you know, it's tough to take it back.
For a company that knows so much about its customers, Facebook really misread them.
I think a lot of what we were trying to do, we just didn't communicate as well as we could have, and a lot of it got lost in that.
CEO Mark Zuckerberg said today Facebook was trying to give users new ways to find each other. Instead, it gave advertisers a new way to find them. In April, many woke up to find new personal information public to the world. Facebook was also feeding info to sites like Pandora and Yelp. You could turn all this off, one click at a time. Now, Zuckerberg says,
there's going to be one simple control for how you want to share all of this stuff. It applies to all the content on the site retroactively.
Too late for users like David Macnett. He even threw an online quit Facebook party to try to get friends to ditch the site as well.
I don't know that I would ever trust them again. The changes have been so distasteful that how can I be sure?
And this latest redo might permanently turn off users like Christy Marshall, who's already feeling Facebook fatigue.
I'm kind of like, ugh, I just feel tired. I just don't want to really be on it anymore.
Facebook has 450 million users. What it doesn't have is a way to maximize revenue from that huge trove of data. Justin Smith runs the blog Inside Facebook.
Facebook's challenge is to find the right middle ground by being good stewards of the information that people have shared with them and trusted with them, while at the same time finding ways to build a business around that.
Long term, no money, no Facebook. Of course, lately more users are thinking they might be okay with that. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
Privacy online is a many-layered thing, so we thought we'd explore the challenges it poses for Facebook and for the rest of us a little bit more. Farhad Manju covers technology for Slate. Farhad, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So let's say I'm sitting at home and I'm a tad skeptical about Facebook and its previous attempts at the privacy thing. Did anything that happened today change my mind?
Well, I think the most important thing is it seems that they're taking privacy seriously in a way that they might not have been before. According to Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO, they kind of holed up in a room for the last few weeks with designers and engineers and other people trying to come up with a brand new privacy system. And the other thing that's important about the new privacy system is not only is it simple, but they say that it will apply to all future changes. So if they unveil a new product at some point in the future, it won't completely change your privacy settings. It'll kind of respect those previous wishes of yours.
Mm-hmm. Although, to judge by the past, their modus operandi, if you will, has been ask for forgiveness, not permission, before they mess around with privacy.
After they make changes, there's usually an outcry. Then they say, usually it's a letter from Mark Zuckerberg on the site, and he apologizes, pledges to do better next time. And then the outcry sort of dies down. And then inevitably what happens is hundreds of millions of people more join the site. So yeah. This seems to be sort of a pattern that goes on.
A lot of the complaints about privacy on Facebook, though, have been not necessarily about me putting my information out there, but corporations and other individuals getting in on that sharing.
The thing that has been unclear about the privacy settings on Facebook is that, you know, you put something out there and you don't know what access everyone on the internet has to it. And by everyone on the internet, that includes kind of developers, programmers who can make write programs to search your information. And with that information, they could plausibly go out and, you know, sell ads that are better targeted to your profile.
Facebook is still privately held. It's not a public company, so we don't know the specifics of this. But can they profitably exist with these privacy concerns, with these problems they've been having?
You know, what Facebook needs to sort of succeed as a business is scale. And it has that scale. It's going to keep growing more. So, you know, if that continues to happen, which there's no sign that it's not, then Facebook, I think, will be doing fine.
What does that say about us as consumers with, in theory anyway, privacy concerns? Not much, does it?
It's this new reality where they understand a little bit that their information is going out there. They're concerned with it. I mean, in surveys and other things, people say they're concerned about privacy online, but they're not really doing anything about it. They're not really acting out on those fears.
Farhad Manju is a technology columnist for Slate. He's a commentator for us every now and then as well. Farhad, good to talk to you.
You too. Thanks a lot.
I don't know if they get tired at the end of the day or what, but traders ran out of gas at the close once again today. The Dow is down below 10,000. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The modern media conundrum is pretty well known. How do papers and magazines survive in the digital age? A key part of any answer is going to be figuring out how to charge for online content. And that is getting increasingly complicated because between Kindles and iPads and smartphones and who knows what that's just around the corner, publishers have a whole new set of price points they have to worry about. Or not worry about. This week, The New Yorker said it's planning to offer a single online all-access subscription, as Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
There are a lot of different ways to get The New Yorker each week. In your mailbox, online, from the newsstand, each one has a slightly different price. This week, David Remnick, the editor, said the magazine will soon start charging a single flat rate to access its content across all different platforms. Peter Kreisky is a media consultant. He says that means for one price, you'll be able to read it anywhere.
So you register once and you get it wherever you want to have it.
Kreisky says getting the same rate across different platforms isn't as hard as you might think. Publishers like Condé Nast just have to negotiate. And if they have strong brands that platforms want to offer their consumers, it makes the negotiating all the easier. He says the reason other content providers aren't pricing this way is because they still haven't figured out the best way to charge for content and keep their readers. He says consumers are willing to pay for content they think is unique or timely.
But they're not prepared to pay for news and information that's viewed as more of a commodity because it's available free everywhere.
Kreisky says if The New Yorker is available in so many different ways, it could win the magazine more subscribers. Rick Edmonds is a media business analyst at the Poynter Institute. He says that could help The New Yorker get what it's really after, more advertising.
They want to get audience. They want to build brand loyalty and kind of with recognition that really monetizing that with strong ad revenues is the work of another day.
The New Yorker says it has about 1 million subscribers, but 4 million readers. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Among the many sayings Benjamin Franklin left us is this one, that in this world nothing can be said to be certain except to death and taxes. The death part is still true, but the way we're taxing after death is changing. That's the point Boston College law professor Ray Madoff makes in her new book. It's called Immortality and the Law. She says dead doesn't really mean dead anymore, financially speaking, because after some intensive lobbying from the banking industry, states have started extending to the well-off dearly departed permanent control over their trusts and estates. Ray, welcome to the program.
A pleasure for me to be here, Kai.
Obviously, somebody has made an argument to lawmakers and to lobbyists, and they said, listen, we think it's good for society if you let people control their money and their inheritances forever. What is that argument like?
If you let us, Alaska legislatures, if you let us change our laws here in Alaska, then all this trust money that's currently in New York or other states will move into our state. And that's exactly what happened in Alaska. The local Alaska bank lobbied the legislatures to make Alaska the most trust-friendly state. And they were quite effective. And after that legislation, they attracted about $4 billion of trust money into the state.
And then the state of Alaska can tax that and reap the benefits and so on.
Interesting is that in order to attract the money, they also have to get the states not to impose income tax on this money. So the only way they benefit is if the banks themselves profit, and then maybe the state can collect some money. But this is really cases where there have been private benefits and unrecognized social costs.
Well, lay out the social costs.
Well, the problem is that right now, estate planners are encouraging their clients to set up these things called dynasty trusts. These are perpetual trusts for the benefit of a person's heirs. However, what people haven't been paying attention to is what the world is going to be like for our children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, etc., when they have to live in a world where some people in society are beneficiaries of this trust and other people aren't.
Seems to me, though, there's nothing more fundamental than being able to decide what you want to have happen to your stuff, whether it's money or your favorite teddy bear from when you were a kid, forever. I mean, it's my stuff. I get to say who gets it, right?
I totally agree with you up until the word forever. People should be able to decide what happens to their stuff, but stuff is something that has to be shared with future generations. Our world today would be very different if the people living before us allowed property to be subject to controls put into place 100 years ago, 200 years ago, or 300 years ago. It's because the people who came before us were mindful of these costs that we are not suffering the burdens of it today. We have to be similarly mindful for future generations. And Thomas Jefferson was very, very mindful of this. Much of his writing was about how the world should be held for the living and the dead shouldn't have control over it.
So back to the point that I started with in this interview, dead doesn't really mean dead anymore, but only if you've got enough money.
It's definitely true. It's really for money people, because in other interests, for example, with respect to reputation and the ability to control our bodies, Americans have virtually no rights at all. We have the clear rule of you're dead and gone, and frankly, we're not that interested in what your views are.
Professor Ray Madoff from Boston College. Her book is called Immortality and the Law, The Rising Power of the American Dead. Professor Madoff, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Kai. It's been a real pleasure.
Coming up, one-size-fits-all financial rules.
We're scrambling every day to make sure that an amendment that was intended to clamp down on the big players doesn't inadvertently hurt community banks.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials lost 69 points today, about 0.7%, 9,974 at the bell. The NASDAQ dropped 15 points, also about 0.7%, 2,195 the number there. The S&P 500 trimmed 6 points, around 0.5%, closed at 1,067. The Commerce Department said new home sales hit a 2-year high in April. That news built up shares of Toll Brothers. It tacked on 0.8%. And it is official today. Apple overtook Microsoft to become the world's biggest technology company. That is measuring them by their market value in the $220 billion range apiece. But both stocks were down today. Apple lost 0.5%. Microsoft unloaded more than 4%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.19%. First time in a couple of days that's happened. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Thursday. President Obama and the First Lady host a reception at the White House in honor of Jewish American Heritage Month. Congressional hearings continue in Washington on issues related to the oil rig explosion in the Gulf. And what's in store where weather is concerned? The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration releases its outlook for the 2010 Atlantic hurricane season. And by the way, it's Hurricane Preparedness Week. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The American labor market is still shaky. Yes, we've started adding jobs, but we are starting from a pretty deep hole. More than 8 million positions disappeared over the past 2.5 years. A news story the other day got David Frum thinking about jobs and the economy and where we might be headed.
Wages down, government benefits up. Yesterday, USA Today published a troubling report on trends in American incomes. Of every $100 received by Americans, less than $42 is earned from private sector wages, the lowest level in recorded history. Of every $100 received by Americans, $18 was received from government programs, a record high. The Drudge Report gave this news an alarmist anti-Obama headline. Redistribution victory, private pay plummets, government handouts soar. Being a savvy marketplace listener, you're probably inclined to poo-poo this alarmism. Of course pay drops during a recession. Of course unemployment benefits rise. You know that's the way the system is supposed to work. Government benefits are what economists call automatic stabilizers. They cushion the pain of recession, or so the theory holds. But this time, the theory isn't working the way it should. private sector wages did not suddenly plunge off the cliff in 2008 when the recession hit. Wages have been steadily dropping as a share of national income for a decade. Government transfers have risen almost equally consistently. Will the shift away from private wages continue even after the economy recovers? With the baby boomers retiring, how can we avoid it? But if we don't avoid it, how are we to pay for it? Jobs and incomes are recovering sluggishly. The healthcare reform creates huge new entitlement programs. Large parts of the Obama stimulus have been made permanent, expanding federal spending into the indefinite future. At the time the United States most desperately needs to create new wealth, we're piling spending atop spending in ways not easily undone. The stabilizers aren't stabilizing. In fact, they're accelerating the whole craft dangerously toward a crash. It's like the design flaw of the Titanic. The deeper it dipped into the sea, the faster it filled with water, thus pulling it deeper, thus filling it faster. And we all know how that ended.
David Frum is the editor of Frum Forum. Do take a second to send us your thoughts, no matter where you're from. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. The mayor of Cleveland, Ohio, thinks he's got a new civic business model. Turns out he's a big believer in sustainability, so he wants to find a company to supply energy-efficient lighting all across the city. But he also wants that company to set up shop in Cleveland and create some much-needed jobs, using the city's purchasing power to drive economic development. Sounds like a fine idea, but Dan Bobkoff from WCPN in Cleveland tells us the first try didn't quite work out.
For Cleveland Mayor Frank Jackson, it sounded like the perfect deal. A Chinese maker of LED lights called Sunpu Opto would locate its U.S. headquarters in Cleveland. In exchange, the city would buy all its efficient street lamps, traffic signals, and office bulbs from the company for the next 10 years. It would be green, save the city money,
and potentially will create over 350 green jobs in Cleveland.
That's the polite applause Mayor Jackson got when he announced the plan in March. But the Sunpu Opto deal quickly became a political nightmare. Many government and business leaders felt left out of the process. Competitors decried the no-bid contract. Others criticized the 10-year time frame because LEDs are still rapidly developing. By the time Cleveland City Council got its hands on the deal, the anger was palpable. This is Councilman Mike Polensic.
This whole process troubles me. When my gut tells me something's wrong, I've been here long enough to know something's not right.
Ed Morrison of Purdue University says Polensic is right to be skeptical. He says the mayor's plan to tie what the city buys to an economic development project is misguided.
That's a very controversial approach. In fact, it's usually not used in local or state government.
Morrison says cities are usually required to choose the lowest bid from lots of companies for each project. But Cleveland would be locked into Sunpu Opto's lights for a decade, even if other firms come out with better, cheaper LED bulbs. It also doesn't help that General Electric's lighting division happens to be based here in the Cleveland area. GE Lighting head Michael Petras called the deal a slap in the face and told City Council that GE didn't have a fair chance.
We kept reaching out, trying to get an audience.
Cleveland Mayor Jackson says the city has never done a deal like this and made some mistakes.
It was a little sloppy, to sum it up.
That's why this week he asked Council to shelve the plan and is starting over. Looking again for an LED supplier that can make everyone happy, whether it's Sunpu Opto or another company. In Cleveland, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner's in Europe today. He's talking to his counterparts there about coming up with some kind of globally consistent rules for financial reform. First things first, though, the House and the Senate have to reconcile their different versions of how American banking ought to be regulated. The big ones, Goldman and Citigroup and the rest, are keeping an eye on the horse trading. So, too, are smaller outfits, including community banks, which are worried about how the compromise bill might affect them. Sarah McCammon reports now from Iowa Public Radio.
Hampton, Iowa is a small farm town about 100 miles north of Des Moines. Brad Davis grew up here, and he's still one of its 4,000 residents. He takes me on a drive around the town square. An old brick courthouse sits in the center, hemmed in by shops and businesses, including the town's single-screen movie theater.
That's the original neon sign when I was a kid.
growing up and going to Mary Poppins and Butch Cassidy and all those movies, that's the same neon sign that I saw 40, 50 years ago. So that's pretty cool.
Today, Davis is president of Hampton State Bank. A few years ago, the bank put together a low-interest loan program aimed at luring back to the area young professionals who had moved away, people like Corrine and Darwin Van Horn.
When I was going into sixth grade, Darwin and I were both at the same church camp, and I had a crush on him all week long, but he gave me no attention whatsoever.
Long story short, he eventually did pay attention. Today, the Van Horns are married with three boys. They recently moved back to the area after more than 20 years away. Corrine says the loan officer at Hampton State Bank worked with them to buy a four-bedroom ranch with a big family room in the basement. It's got twice the space of their old house.
I don't know how much time he spent with me. He really spelled things out, compared the different rates, showed me the advantage for us, knowing that we want to be here long term.
Brad Davis says his bank staff worked months to develop the loan program. He worries finding time to create similar programs could get harder if the financial reform bill clamps down on small banks along with big investment banks.
So if we get too much regulation, what we're going to find is that community banks are not going to be able to put those resources that they need towards economic development. I think it's a threat not only to the banks but to the communities they serve.
Davis worries particularly about proposals to establish a new consumer financial protection agency to regulate things like mortgages and credit cards. He says more rules mean more paperwork and less time for his staff of about a dozen to generate new business. It's a concern shared by Steve Verdier with the Independent Community Bankers of America. It represents more than 5,000 small banks across the country. On one hand, Verdier wants Congress to rein in banks considered too big to fail. But he says small banks fear a one-size-fits-all approach to new regulation.
We're scrambling every day to make sure that an amendment that was intended to clamp down on the big players doesn't inadvertently hurt community banks.
But Kathleen Day with the Center for Responsible Lending says it's important to have the same rules for all banks, large and small, to protect consumers and investors.
You want everyone to have to stop at the stop sign. You don't want some people to be able to go cruising through it at 60 miles an hour and cause a wreck and not have to get a ticket.
After all, Day says, the main goal of reform is to keep the banking industry on sound footing so it can help customers with their financial needs. In Hampton, Iowa, I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today by way of the foreign exchange markets, the European debt crisis, and Beijing. You know how we say from time to time that China has the world's biggest foreign reserves, basically holdings in other countries' currencies? They've got more than $1 trillion U.S. in the bank, a healthy amount of euros, too. And that's why a report from the Financial Times today is worth noting. Officials from China's State Administration of Foreign Exchange are talking about reviewing their euro-denominated debt holdings. Reviewing as in not in a good way. The thing to notice here, by the way, is that just about the time that report hit the web is when Wall Street took its big drop for the day. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow dropped 69.6%. The NASDAQ off 15 points, also 0.6%. The S&P 500 fell 6 points. That's about 0.5%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this radio broadcast, The Gap's new shopping app.
When it comes to mobile, it's got to be simple and it has to be contextual. And by contextual, it needs to be personal, it needs to be tied to my location, it needs to be tied to my past behavior.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.